Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast with your host, Andrew Keel. This is the podcast where you can get the education you need to invest 100% passively in the highly profitable niche of mobile home parks.
Welcome to the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Keel, and today I'm excited to welcome Matthias Grunwald, co-founder and managing partner of WCG Investments. Matthias is a real estate investor and operator with over 18 years of leadership experience. Originally from Germany, he moved to the US in 2012 and recently transitioned from global automotive manufacturing to a full-time real estate investor. Today, he oversees approximately $45 million in assets under management across 25 manufactured housing communities. Matthias, welcome to the show, brother.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
You bet, man. Would you mind starting out by sharing a little about your story and how in the world you got into mobile home parks?
Man, I love that question. How did that German guy get into trailer parks? That's my favorite question, man. Yeah, it's kind of a long story, but compressed, like you mentioned, in 2012, I moved from Germany to the US. Back then, I was in Greenville, South Carolina, because it's where the W-2 opportunity was for me. Mm-hmm. Was working in manufacturing in fast-paced, high-stake environment. You know, customers were General Motors and BMW and all these guys, Ford, Chrysler, all these massive corporations. And at some point, I realized, hey, man, I'm just working on somebody else's balance sheet and make that guy rich. You know, my boss's boss had a Ferrari collection, you know, and I was, you know, just struggling making ends meet. You know what I mean? I mean, we did pretty well. Don't get me wrong. I wasn't an executive there. But I was like, man, how do the rich get rich and how do the wealthy get wealthy? I literally put that into Google around the COVID time frame because everything slowed down and our business slowed down too, was where I was working at. And I literally Googled that and it came up real estate, you know, drives a lot of wealth and it's good wealth preservation, also a good wealth building tool. So yeah, then I started my side hustle, basically buying a duplex out of a cash out refi on my primary residence, bought a duplex because I always liked multi-unit properties, just vibe with my logic. The more units, the better, I thought, because economy of scale and somebody moves out, you have more income on the other side of the property at least. And then, you know, I bought a fourplex right after in 2023. And then in late 2023, bought an apartment complex, actually, a 26 unit with JV partners. And right after, then I did an RV park, which then got me in contact with my main partner, Tim Woodbridge, who did mobile home parks for many years already. And he showed me the dark side of mobile home parks, always joking. And since then, the rest is history. We bought a lot of mobile home parks in the meantime. And we had over, you know, 25 mobile home parks right now, 1,100 units and 45 million assets under management. I'm doing it full time now and having a blast.
Wow. 1,100 units, dude. That's amazing. And in such a short time frame. Tell me, so do you still own the 26 unit apartment complex?
Unfortunately, I do. Yeah.
Why do you say that? Why do you say unfortunately?
It wasn't well managed in the beginning, unfortunately. So we had a couple of capital calls. So it's a good deal on paper. It was just not executed well. It's on the turnaround right now. There was a lot of overspending on the CapEx side and stuff. And it didn't really, you know, perform well from a cash flow perspective. Like the rent projections were way overly optimistic. Location is great. The asset itself is great, but it just hasn't been well executed. And for me, from an operational background, I immediately recognize where the problem is coming from, obviously. So our partners kind of put our heads together and see what needs to be changed. And we did that. And now we are reaping the benefits from it. It's turning around, but we still have to catch up on a lot of things. But, you know, that experience plus the skills that I learned from my W-2, from my, you know, 18-year-long career in operations really helped me a lot to understand how we have to run things in our mobile home park business. So that made me and Tim very successful building WCG Investments.
That's great. So that was like your first syndication then, was the 26-unit apartment complex?
That was a joint venture, actually. The first syndication was, we got on a contract early 2024, so just like 2 years ago. That was our first syndication, wow, which was a 100-unit portfolio of four parks in Spartanburg, South Carolina. These days, I live in Tampa, Florida, but I still lived in Greenville, South Carolina back then, and we bought this 2 years ago. So it was right in my backyard, and I realized the location is phenomenal where this mobile home park sits. And I knew Tim from the RV park that we did a JV on as well. And then he always raved about mobile home parks, and I pitched a deal to him. I was like, I think this is a major opportunity. And then, you know, we made an offer and we got on the contract. And, you know, again, the rest is history. That's the first syndication out of eight we did since then.
That's amazing. Yeah, you've done so well, so much so soon. But tell me, so Tim has been on the podcast, big Tim fan, the former nurse that, you know, turned into a full-time real estate investor. So how did you and Tim meet up and become JV partners? I guess it was first on an RV park. That was your first deal you guys did together?
Yes, that's correct. So we both were part of a mastermind that was based out of Charleston, South Carolina, which is close where I lived and very close where Tim lived at the time. And it was just like a local like mastermind that kind of went nationwide. There's a lot of people that nationwide that joined it. And they focused mainly on multifamily, that mastermind. But I had like a subgroup of mobile home parks. And that's how I met Tim. And then also that's how we got into like a part of that group. They bought RV park together and they pulled me and Tim in from, you know, for managing and asset managing the RV park. And then when we started working together, we realized, hey, man, I like you. And he was like, I like you, too. And we were kind of working well together. It's kind of like the, you know, the stepbrothers moment. Did we just become best friends kind of deal? It kind of worked. And, you know, sometimes you're looking for a great partner. I think the same with dating. If you like desperately looking for that partner, you're not going to find it. But that one day just going to cross that path with that one person, all of a sudden it clicks. And that's how it was for me and Tim. It just worked so well out of the gate. And it's amazing. Like we're so different too. Like where he comes from, where I come from, you know, even like lifestyle is different, but we have the same core values and it makes the business decision that we make together so aligned. It's incredible. It's very, I realize it's very rare, but it's working so well for us.
That's fantastic, man. What was the name of that mastermind that you guys met in?
Yeah, very cheesy name. It was called My First Million in Multifamily. Exactly. They call it the deal room in short.
Yeah. The deal room. Okay, cool. Yeah. Well, hey, it worked, right?
It worked.
Put together and you're doing deals. So
I'm grateful for it.
And so you bought your first group of parks, those four in Spartanburg in early 24. Was that when you first started managing mobile home parks then? Is that your role in there?
Yeah, that was my first mobile home park that we purchased. Yep, correct.
Okay. And I mean, it's March 2026 right now. So it's been about 2 years. Yeah. Tell me, like, how was the beginning, like scratch starting a management company? Do you manage it yourself? Do you have a third party that manages those parks? You know, tell us how that's been.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we self-manage everything. So actually, Tim started that before we even started working together. So he had a couple of mobile home parks already, and he had his own property management company that he founded to support his portfolio. And then we just kept the same system because I like the self-management part. As long as you have a team in place, if you do everything yourself, you go crazy. But we had he had VAs already, and we built up on that system and systematized everything and really built SOPs left and right. And build out, you know, that property management system and the back office, we call it. And yeah, from there, I mean, it's still today. Sometimes you get overwhelmed with the issues. But, you know, the more you actually train the back office team how to respond in certain situations, the quieter it gets. It sounds weird, but it's just how it goes. And I use some little tricks here and there. I mean, I'm using AI as everybody does these days. And, you know, we have like a WhatsApp group with the back office and they're asking questions here and there. Sometimes you get a question a day. Sometimes it's 25 questions that one day. And I at some point, periodically, I just download like the WhatsApp transcript and say, hey, here's our conversation for the last 6 months. Please make an FAQ out of this. And then just create an FAQ document. So whenever somebody comes on the team new, this is a training document for them. And I have an FAQ where I can go through all the frequently asked questions, you know, like little stuff like this. Just trying to be smart about it. How to eliminate, you know, a friction within the process was very helpful for us. And like documenting everything. So it breaks down the touch points of communication that you don't get a million questions. And you have like a back office really independent at some point. And they're communicating with the community managers that live on site or close to the portfolio or to the property, so to speak. And that helps a lot. So we basically like just like asset managing at this point. And we own that property management company, but we don't do the property management. We really just asset managing. And then we just usually the tiebreaker if there's some, you know, legal issues or somebody's really pissed off about something, you know, it happens, you know, when you're in the rental business, and then we jump in if needed. But otherwise, it's pretty passive, so to speak.
Tell us about the management company. What does that look like? How many employees do you have to manage? What is it, 1,100 units? Yeah. Just tell us like how you have it set up, because I know you guys have some VA involvement and so forth.
Correct. So we have one person's collections VA. He just does collections all day long. We have an executive assistant. We have a leasing agent that just does leasing all day. Maintenance VA, that person is really just dispatch. We have a vendor list for each region where we say, okay, those are the approved vendors. And they can basically call them and just be dispatch. I see maintenance requests coming through in Rent Manager, and they can, okay, they see it's plumbing in Sumter, South Carolina. Okay, call Jeremy. Boom, send him out. You know, and if there's somebody needs to be on site for something, there's a question, the community manager will get involved. So it's kind of like playing dispatch. That's how we have it set up. And then we also have a bookkeeper as well. That's on the VA team that does all the bookkeeping for us at the moment. And then we actually be buying 5 more properties right now, which is 283 units. We are closing on in 2 months. And then we actually implementing AI agents right now for collections and maintenance, where all the mundane communication, just constantly calling people, hey, you're behind in your rent, will be AI in the future for us. And then our VA that we have for collections will be more of a sniper rifle, because the AI agent will actually collect data on if somebody's willing to actually make payments and has intention to do a payment plan. That person, our VA, will then call them to create a creative payment plan, which he's doing already. But right now, he wastes a lot of time in calling everybody that's behind. If you have 1,100 units, you might have to call 200 people or 150 people. It's a lot. And not everybody gets on the phone, and you're wasting a lot of time. So the AI is going to break down that volume, so to speak, and then really make him like a sniper rifle and targeting really where it's worth targeting, talking to people to create payment plans and stuff. So that's how we have it currently structured. So it's pretty lean for the size of portfolio because we run pretty efficiently.
That's great. No, that's really cool. I like how you're leveraging AI. You know, we're still timid, right, with how to implement AI into the management company. But I think whoever figures that out will definitely have a leg up, you know, for sure. Okay, very cool. Let me ask you this. This is kind of just candid, but what part of the business sucks the most for you?
Oh, man, that's a very good question. What sucks the most? Whew. Park on homes can suck sometimes.
I feel that.
Yeah.
Tell us what, you know, what you mean by that.
Yeah, we buy a lot of parks at park on homes because we like to turn them over to rent to own. And as soon as you do, it's
Southeast. In the Southeast, I don't know about this, but it seems like that's what every mom and pop did, is they wanted to own all the homes and they wanted just to have a flat apartment complex. It's the wildest thing.
It is. It's very true. And it's a lot of people don't touch them because of that, because they want the holy grail, tenant-owned homes only, and you know, public utilities. Great, I want them too. But sometimes you have to kind of, you know, find a value add out there. And the turning the POHs over the TOHs to tenant-owned homes over time is a good value add. Especially if you run syndications, you can use the extra POH cash flow that you're getting for actually making investor payments and distributions, which helps a lot. But what it can suck is if you take them over from a mom and pop, and there's 100 parkrun homes, and they've all been just patched together with duct tape and chewing gum, then you're going to have a lot of issues. And then try to figure out, you have to become really creative. You know, you do a lot of handyman specials, but sometimes a handyman special needs to be somewhat savable, you know, and then you're on the edge sometimes. Okay, is this savable? Is this a demo? And, you know, that's where it becomes really, there's a lot of friction involved. And usually we did take over a lot of portfolios with POHs. The first 6 months suck in the initial stabilization phase, and then we getting a lot of those off to rent to own and turn some over time. And then 6 to 8 months, we just had another one. We just hit the 6 month mark and it's finally quiet, where it's just our repair maintenance was $8,000 a month on that portfolio. Now it's $700, you know, after 6 months. It the beginning sucks. You just, everything is broken, because if you start to sell a property, you probably start neglecting it at some point, and it was probably already neglected. And so once you've taken all these park on homes over, they're just, everything was bad. I mean, that one portfolio we bought, we had 34 maintenance requests in 24 hours, in day one when we took over. It was overwhelming, to say the least.
Oh, I bet. I bet. No, you gave me a good idea for a new podcast. Duct tape and chewing gum, you know, Taylor Park Tales. You know, I'm thinking something along those lines. But no, totally agree. Yeah, we buy some park-owned home parks as well and do the conversions. And yeah, it definitely gets overwhelming. So you guys use Rent Manager as well?
We do.
Nice, which is convenient because they can do the maintenance request right through the tenant portal. So that's a good software. So Matthias, I mean, obviously you partner with Tim, but how'd you get educated on mobile home parks, you know, before buying those first 4 parks in Spartanburg? How did you kind of dive in and you know, just talking to the newer investors out there, How do you recommend someone get educated, and then how did you get educated?
Yeah, that's a good question. I love networking. Just go to conferences, talk to the people, and find the bigger players, and then just ask always, hey, who should I talk to? I'm just getting started on Mobile Home Parks. I love the asset class. Who is somebody I should meet? Maybe I can provide some value to them, for example. And just be in the room of the bigger players. And I think the bigger the players become, the more helpful they are, and they want to see you succeed because they have an abundance mindset. Otherwise, I would have never gotten there. So when I got started, I mean, I had a okay portfolio, but I wasn't something to write home about, really, compared to some people I met in the mobile home park industry, and met some really good players that have 4,000 or 5,000 units, and have been more than willing to help me out and help Tim out, you know, to understand how to raise capital, how to create a fund, open up a fund, how to run syndications, how to do the accounting properly for syndication, stuff like that, all the legal paperwork and everything that you have to do, the PPMs and all that stuff. People have been so helpful, and we would have never gotten so far so quickly without asking the right questions to the right people. And I love this saying, the quote of like, if you want to know the road ahead, ask the people coming back. And I love to sit down with lunch with people that have 4,000 to 5,000 lots, and then just ask them like, hey, when you were like 500 units or 1,000 where we are right now, and you walk the path to 2,000 units, what mistakes did you do that I shouldn't do? And just listen, you know, and it's so magical, like how much wisdom you get out of them. It's great.
Tell us about that. Like what has been some of the best, you know, little tidbits that you've been able to capture from some of those mentors?
So we're creating our first fund right now. So I had lunch with somebody that has a really sizable portfolio. So close to, I think he sold like 1,000 units. So he's like 3,500. So he was almost at 5,000. And he told me as well, like, if you really build a sizable business out of this, try to act with the end in mind and build everything in house as much as you can, because he did outsource a lot. And then he realized, oh, we're so big now. And when I outsource this, it becomes so expensive. Now I bring it in house, but now the operations are so massive. The external company, to bring that in house, you have to build an entire department. So try to build it. Like, if you really want to get to 4,000 to 5,000 lots, build the accounting department, build the property management department from the ground up from day one, because you have total control about everything and you keep costs under control because you're maintaining the cost. You have different cost centers, obviously, but also become profit centers. Like, I live off the property management fees, and so does my partner. You know, we take a profit share of whatever is left from the property management fees we charge to the properties. And that helped us a lot to not have in the W-2, right? So this stuff we also learned from another mentor. He did the same thing, like, hey, the property management company that I founded is not really a profit center because I take all the profits from it, in a sense. Like, the company itself is really just, you know, breaking even, if that makes sense. But I'm pulling the profits from that company to kind of live off of it as well. So those nuggets help a lot to like open up your mindset to see like, oh yeah, that's how I can structure this, right? And if I would go for a party property management company, I might charge 10, 12, 13% off gross for like for the income, right? Because lot rents are lower than apartment rents, for example, and they probably won't do a good job because it's not their property. So if you charge 8 to 10%, we charge 10, kind of industry standard off gross, you know, that's some significant income. And then if you have a lot more AI coming in, you don't have to hire people like crazy every time you add more properties. That's why we do it that way. So our profit margin actually gets bigger and stuff like that. So we learned that from, you know, the bigger players as well. So that was very, very powerful. Same with accounting. Like I just mentioned, we were thinking like maybe we need like a fraction CFO and get a accounting firm involved for our financials. And I talked to that one mentor. He said, you know what? The same thing. It got so expensive and it got really brutal to bring it in-house. Do it in-house right now. It might be a little more expensive right now, but it will be so much cheaper 10 years down the road. So learned that a lot from these people. Yeah.
That's good advice. So which events did you go to? Which conferences to meet these mentors?
Yeah, there's some good ones for mobile home parks out there. I mean, there's MHI has several ones, right? I think it goes between like, you know, they have in Orlando. I think Orlando was last year. I think it's Vegas this year. MHI is pretty good. Also, a little hack for the audience. I didn't do it yet, but I will do it next time. Like, some of these, you have to pay some significant admission fees, like $800-$900 or so, depending on when you do the sign up. But most of the people hang out in the lobby and you don't need a ticket for the lobby. So if you have not much money, just go to those events and go to the lobby and talk to the people. Because usually when you go into like the expo and go to the vendors, you need a, you know, like a lanyard and, you know, your name on it and stuff. But, you know, if you're just getting started, you can just hang out in these lobbies and just talk to the people there. I saw several people doing this. I'm like, this is pretty smart. I like when people are smart with their money. What's the other one? That's Seco is pretty operator heavy as well. That's in Atlanta. every year. I think it's around September. I was there last year as well. That's pretty good. It's very operator focused. The good vendors are there, good speakers. That one's pretty powerful. I like the one in Louisville, the Manufactured Housing Show, where actually like there's a big expo center in Louisville, Kentucky. It's always in January. So it was just 2 months ago when they're showing all these, you know, manufactured homes from different manufacturers in this big expo center. And in the middle, it's like all the vendors you can imagine, like all the AI I've been talking about. I met that company there and I had dinner with them. So you meet a lot of people there and find new tools, talk to the operators. There's some big players there. So yeah, those are my favorite ones. And you can go to some generic real estate ones. You know, I've been to Best Ever Conference, which is really more multifamily focused, but there's also a lot of people there that invest and they're fund managers and they want to invest in other deals. So you can kind of find, you know, some partners there as well. So there's different companies out there that serve different purposes.
Sounds good, brother. Let me ask you this. Let's get into like the nuts and bolts of mobile home parks, right? So what do you wish you knew sooner, right? Like that you know now about mobile home park operations and management specifically. Like, what do you wish that you knew like day one after you closed on those four parks in Spartanburg?
Oh, man, that's a fantastic question. So that's one takeaway, but that's tax related, actually. But management related, I must say, I mean, the park owner homes scared me a little. They still suck. But now I'm like, I know what to do now. I think that's the one. When we closed on Spartanburg, we actually ended up in the news in the first week because the seller stopped responding to the tenants 2 months prior to closing. And the people already thought we bought it already and they found out who's buying it. And we were immediately in the news in the first week. So talk about stress levels right there. They actually did a very, very negative, almost like damaging news report about me and Tim in the news about like we taking the park over and we haven't responded to any maintenance requests or nothing. And actually we just closed like 2 days ago. And everybody thought and the news was out there handing out business cards because they want to get more and more of the story. And then we actually talked to the news outlet and then they realized, oh, we kind of reached a little bit far here. And then the more favorable news report after, and then it quieted down. And we actually went in and improved the park as well. So that's something we learned right away, like making sure when we close on the deal as well, that we, as soon as we know we're going to close, we make the seller actually notify the tenants that we are, when the closing is, and there's going to be a management shift that comes from our first deal we did together. Because of that first deal, we got grilled by the news because everybody thought we closed 2 months ago, where we didn't. And I talked to the property manager that they had, the local community manager, and she said, oh yeah, the owner told me to shut my phone off like 2 months ago. Like, don't even respond to the people anymore. Yeah, yeah, we went from like crazy. eight vacant homes to like 21 vacant homes from when due diligence ended to when we closed. We went from like
Did you renegotiate like the day before closing? We always checked the day before closing because we had a home burned down one time and we were able to get a credit. We just took the purchase price and divided by the number of occupied units and got a credit. But to have that many vacancies, oh, that's terrifying.
That was bad. Actually, it's a good idea. We should start doing that. We did a drive through, but we didn't check all the homes because there was 100 homes and there was 59 parkrun homes. We walked them all during the diligence. There was a major delay also in the closing because the seller didn't send in the titles in time. That I think there was like 2 days before closing, he sent them in. And then the lender's attorney was like, I need more time here. So that was not a delay. So it took forever. And then in that time, they just couldn't care less about management anymore. So that's all the vacancies happened. But I like the idea, Andrew. I would definitely take that with me and bring it to our team.
A lot of times, another thing is when we're buying from mom and pops, a lot of times they just kind of like, just like you said, they just stop responding to the tenants. So we created like a template letter from the seller. And then the seller just basically says, yeah, this is good. And then we pass those out like right after closing as if the information. And then, you know, the next day we'll deliver the introduction like letter from, you know, stating who we are. But man, that's crazy that he just stopped responding to people, you know, well before closing. That is just, oh, that's terrifying. All right. I got a bunch of questions I want to get through here. All right. So let's just get right to the nuts and bolts. Okay. What are the top three operational levers that consistently move NOI the most in mobile home parks?
Collections. You have to be on top of people for paying. I think collections is really important. That's what our VA team reports that number twice a day. First thing in the morning and the end of day. We have collections, delinquency, I mean, also leasing, if you have a lot of parkour homes, you want to sell them as rental owns. We have a lot of leasing metrics too. Like we look at inquiries and then application to lease conversions and stuff like that. So we look at that as well. Once you have, we have parks to be bought with all tenant on homes. We don't need that metric because they are mainly occupied. I mean, we have one park, it's 100% occupancy, all tenant on homes. It's mainly collections only we're looking at on that one, really. It's stabilized and it's all working beautifully there. It's really passive at that point. But all the other ones, they're heavy under heavy value add still and have a lot of POHs. I think collections on all of them. And then if there's a lot of turnover, definitely on the leasing front, I would look at those as well. Yep.
Where do most owners think they're running a tight operation, but are actually bleeding money?
CapEx, probably, because that bleeds you really quickly, because it could be just 2,000 here, 3,000 there, 1,500 there. And you look back, you spend $80,000 in CapEx on bigger deals, that is. But especially on bigger deals, that happens really fast. And then again, POHs can be very dangerous. You can really overspend. That happened to us too, man. It happened so quick. Like we had a different asset manager on another deal managing it for us. And I look back on the financials, like, where did we spend $15,000 on what? And then apparently we did like this beautiful renovation on like a 1995 home. I was like, what? Why are we spending $15,000 on a, you know, almost 30-year-old home? At this point, it was almost 30 years old. I'm like, this is crazy, guys. We cannot spend $15,000. We maybe spend $3,000 to $5,000 and then do a handyman special, all of this, you know? It happens really fast. With some people think we do like some beautiful fix and flip and it has to be perfect. You know, we don't have to do that. It depends on the market. You can, in some markets, you get away with some crappier inventory, you know, where you can just like, okay, let's get it safe, get it livable, but don't paint the walls or nothing. Somebody comes in, handyman special, and he will paint it. So I think that's going to happen really quick, CapEx on POHs especially.
Totally. What separates a great on-site manager from an average one in this asset class?
Oh, yeah, I love that because we had both before. Communication is really important, and also decision-making skills. We had a community manager where they did not make any decisions, like anything. They brought up every single problem to us. We had to make the decision for them. Whereas we teaching everybody and everybody on our team, especially community managers, if you have a problem, bring up three solutions because you're on site, you have all the details, bring up at least three solutions and give us your recommended solution so we can know, okay, what is the best solution here properly. And if you give them that mindset framework, sometimes they actually answer their own questions, don't even ask you in the first place. And then also giving people then the freedom that they can make decisions. If they do mistakes, then you support them by their mistakes because it's how we all grow, right? With failure sometimes. But I think that makes a big difference on a good community manager and a bad one is just to have really somebody that can have some critical thinking skills and can make their own decisions really. And it's more about work ethic and mindset than actually skills. I think if you have somebody that never managed a mobile home park before, she manages now 450 units of our 1,100 right now. With a helper, and she absolutely kills it because she has the right attitude. And she had zero idea. She had a million questions in the beginning, but she gets it now. She asks every question just like once, and then she gets it, and it never comes up again. She learns from it. So that makes a big difference, just the mindset, really, and the work ethic.
Yeah, that's huge. What operational edge will separate the top 10% of operators going forward?
KPIs. Keep a tight grip on your KPIs. Know exactly what your business is. Have a pulse on it the entire time. I think if you don't watch your KPIs, you don't know what's happening in your business. And I think that makes a difference between the top 10 and then anybody else that's average. Because you can always look at your bank account and say, oh, that's money in there. That's great. But how did it get there? And is some of it earmarked for taxes? Some of it earmarked for investor payments? You know, like just the accounting structure as well is very important, you know, because we carve everything out in different accounts, like every property or every entity that has sometimes portfolios in it has like five bank accounts, you know, for tax, escrow, insurance, tenant deposits, CapEx account, et cetera. And, you know, having KPIs, you know, overarching over the entire entity and just seeing where the pulse is for everything is really powerful. And we actually just snatched somebody up from a really large portfolio. He managed 14,000 units for somebody that's very well known. I'm not going to say their name because we poached the guy. But he built a really powerful dashboard for us in Power BI. So we have one screen, one pager overview, which is very interactive, where we can see the entire portfolio, our occupancy, vacancies, NOI.
What'd you say that was? He built it in Power BI?
Yeah, it's a Microsoft tool, correct. And it pulls all the data live out of Friend Manager. Every day at 8 a.m., it does like a data pool, and then it just basically you can just log in and then just see like the most recent data. And then you can actually click in, we can go in and click on different properties and actually drill down each property and also each expense line item. What is really cool is like if you do the asset management part, you can actually look in and say, where do we spend the most money in our entire portfolio? And it could be utilities, it could be this, could be that. So it's really powerful to actually see like where all the money goes or where the money is coming from and what region it's coming from the most, where is the highest profit in that region? Is this market strong? As you're getting bigger, you can pull that data at some point and say like, hey, you know what? A lot of the upstate of South Carolina are really good because our NOI is really strong there. Expense rates are really stable. But in this market down south, like South Georgia, we have more issues there. Why? And we can ask more questions and that tightens up our acquisitions too because of that data. That's what I mean. Like the top 10 operators always have the data under control and actually analyze the data. Don't only have it and ignore it. That makes no sense either. It's like having vitamins in on your shelf. Like you have to actually take them, man. You have to, you know, do something with it. Don't just look at them.
100%. Let's talk to the new investor that is just getting started. They've saved money. They want to buy their first mobile home park. You know, what would you focus on mastering first, right? Like if you're that investor, what would you tell them?
Oh, yeah. Very good question. Master the networking game. Because
why?
It's all about figuring out, first of all, be likable. I think if you're a jerk, you won't make it fun, any business. And I think work on that first, if that's in the room for improvement. I'm probably very German here, but very direct, but that's how we are. But yeah, the networking part, because that's how I got involved with Tim. And then Tim knows a lot of other people, and I know a lot of people, and our network grew stronger and stronger. And people talk about the good things that we're doing, and that piques interest of investors. And investors put money in the deal, and then we make them money, and then they put that money into the next deal. And then they're so happy they got money back. They tell their friends that they made money with us, and they want to invest too. And then they tell their friends, and it's just the snowball that gets bigger and bigger. So if you have some money saved and you get started, invest in yourself first by education. That just could be just buying books. I mean, I got started, I read like 30 plus books in the first year. And then go to conferences and talk to people, get involved, and then connect with the right people. Because this is a team sport, 100%. You won't be, if you're just buying a park or two, you might be fine alone. But if you want to get into a bigger size, you definitely need a team. If it's just like a partner and a couple of VAs, that's still a team. You need those skills of like building the relationships and being well connected, especially if you want to raise capital. It's really important that you're out there and have a positive brand and can connect with people well. So that will be my biggest recommendation.
Let's go back real quick to the book question. So you said you read 30 books. You know, what one book would you recommend that taught you the most, you know, about the business?
Mobile home park specifically or real estate in general?
I would say mobile home park specifically.
I have it in my background, actually. Am I Being Too Subtle by Sam Sell. He's a, of course, business rebel, they call him, is what it says in the title. And he is still, I think, his group. And he passed away, unfortunately. Rest in peace. But I think his group is the biggest owner of mobile home parks in the country. I think it's Equity Life Group, I believe. And they have 140,000 units. So that's my favorite book because I love how he approached business and how much humor he had at the same time, but also how tenacious he was of building that business. And he was so far ahead of everybody, knowing where the trends are heading, which is super difficult to figure out. But the way he looked at it was very impressive when I read his book because he was investing in mobile home parks decades ago. Like even like 10 years ago, you may have seen it coming, you know, and Warren Buffett, was making investments in the industry in a sense as well and stuff like that. But he did it like 20, 30 years ago when he started doing mobile home parks. And he jokingly in the book, he shows there's a picture, an illustration of it. He walked around in a T-shirt and said in the back, it said, for the last time, Jerry, this is not a trailer park. And it's like, you know, strangling a chicken or something. It's like making fun of the stigma, basically. But he loved the mobile home park industry. And I loved just to look at how far ahead he was in his time. I think that really impressed me the most. It's where I learned the most when I read the book. And that's why it's in my background. This is not staged. I read it and I always read it once a year just to kind of remind myself of like, you know, how much of an impact he had. And he bought a lot of property.
Let me ask you this. What was like your major takeaway from the book? Like he's definitely a visionary. I totally agree with you. But what was like your major takeaway that like helped you in your business?
Oh, wow. Major takeaway. It goes back to what I said earlier, right? It's a team sport. He was always leaning on his team. I mean, he was a visionary, but he needed integrators and partners. He was talking about his partners and was raving about them, how how strong they were in his business and how much impact they made. And his, I forgot their names, but he also mentioned people that mentored him. Back to what I just mentioned about the relationships. There were people that actually mentored him. They were from large companies. And they just took him under his wings and he learned from them. And that's also, you have to have an open mindset to learn and learn from mentors. So that, those were the biggest takeaways. Like a person like Sam gotten that big, he didn't stumble into this. He was also well connected and being open-minded and finding mentors and provide value to them. I think that's very important. Don't just go to somebody because they have 5,000 units and say, hey, how do I do this? No. Ask them, how can I provide value to you? And they will definitely help you, but provide some value too, whatever that is. You know?
No, I think like from earlier when you were talking about mentors and you were talking about networking, I thought you were going to relay that back to the book because Sam Zell, yeah, he definitely connected from his time at Michigan, right? When he was doing the student housing and all the way through to Chicago and those big names that he partnered with, or the time when he worked at the law firm, right? He wasn't very long. It was a brief stint, but yeah, that's a great book. So appreciate you sharing that with us. I'll put a link to that. Am I being too subtle in the show notes? But let's talk about your acquisitions pipeline. Let's talk about, you know, your buy box. What does your buy box look like? What's a deal that you guys would buy? You know, what's size, utilities? What do you tell people that your buy box is?
Yeah. So buy box right now, we buy in the Southeast, mobile home parks only. We do park on homes, but we only do park on homes if we have a population over 50,000 people in the area. That doesn't have to be in that town, but it has to be at least in the proximity in the metro of like 50,000 people. Because if you want to turn them over to rent to owns, we need a lot of lead flow to get them off the books, so to speak, quickly. We don't do lagoons. We don't do wastewater treatment plants. We do septic because you got that in the South a lot. There's a lot of septic and we have probably hundreds of septic at this point. But maybe I would say probably 20% of portfolio septic, not a big deal. We had one replacement before, plenty of pumpings. At this point, I want to open a septic pumping company at this point as another vertical because we have so much right now, but it's not a big deal. We underwrite for it. That's our buy box right there. Did I miss something? Size wise. So we basically like 200 plus units right now. Because as we're getting bigger, the bigger deals, you realize the bigger deals are easily managed than like the 40 units or the 20 units. As you have more zeros, of course, you have to know what you're doing. If you're wrong on your rent projections, you're wrong 200 times. So you have to be very careful how you underwrite that stuff. But especially in markets that you know pretty well, you have some confidence there in your numbers. The deal we have under contract right now, we just got under contract a few weeks ago, is 283 units, which need some vacant park on homes need to be turned. And there's a couple vacant lots right there. So far it looks pretty good due diligence wise, like everything financially checks out. And as you're getting into like the bigger portfolios that you're buying, you can tell like the sophistication increases. It's not too much mom and pop anymore. It's a sophisticated operator. So the financials are pretty clean. You get better feedback. When you dabble around to 40 units, 50 units, we bought many of those. There's sometimes like almost no supporting data. It's on their head sometimes, even the financials.
Yeah. Okay. How are you currently finding those deals?
Yeah. So mainly that's my partner's Tim's world. He's mainly in acquisition. So we're building out off-market pipelines right now, but mainly broker relationships. We here know a lot of no's. So we make a lot of offers. And we also have like a multi-tier offer as well, where we do like a cash to close offer, then seller carry with a second position and also seller financed. And as you know, you have those three different levers, you have they're usually higher numbers, like seller finance, you would do like 10% down, 20% down, but it's a lower rate, interest only, whatever. So you can pay a lot more. And sometimes that gets a deal done. And we struck a couple of deals that way last year, which is pretty good with mom and pop operators. But it's mainly through brokers, and we close a couple deal brokers and they give us pocket listings. You know, of course, if depends how good the relationship is with a broker. Sometimes you're the only one seeing it, but most likely not. There's other people too, but at least it's not on the market. So we have a little bit less competition. But so far we did most of our deals basically off market, but of deals that have been on the market for a longer period of time. And we got it at a major discount because I realized it was overpriced. And it was just like the tenacious follow-up That's what my partner Tim does really well, and also in a very nice way how he follows up and how to get the deal done. I think that's where he's a master at that skill, because I think it's like his nursing background too. He knows how to talk to people. I think that helps a lot too. So where I'm the more abrasive, rougher, you know, harsh operations guy, I'm a little bit too direct. I can talk to brokers pretty well too, but Tim is a lot better than me on that front. So yeah, that's how we get it done.
That's great. That's awesome. Let me ask you, so like, what are the biggest red flags you watch out for when acquiring a new park?
Mainly the financials, really. We're really looking forward to looking under the hood of the financials, the bank accounts, the general ledgers. So if somebody has like rent manager already, I'm much relieved because I can really just pull the GL report and look at the financials, balance sheet, and get the bank statements and get everything reconciled. That way, if somebody doesn't have any of that, and they don't have to have rent manager, don't get me wrong, but if they just have like financials on the back of a napkin, you really have to know what you're doing to buy that asset, because you have to know the market, you have to know what you can get out of this, and maybe bake in some good reserves, because you might lose your shirt in the beginning and have negative cash flow a good bit. So we had one deal on the contract early 2025 where we thought like, man, this is such a home run deal. You know, we bought it at like a 15 cap. I would have bought it at a 15 cap. But we're like, this is a 15 cap. Something must be wrong here. And the more we've been asking questions, like the more we realized that the numbers never lined up, like verbally or in writing. And then we asked more and more questions. And the more we looked at bank statements, it was so muddy because their personal finances went through the bank account, through the rental income on one bank account. It was impossible to see where stuff was coming from because they got all the rent payments cash. So it was cash deposits, and everything was a mess. And then at some point we realized, like from like conversations, that the income was about like, it went from $400,000 income to like 210 or so was what we actually reconciled. So almost half, and dropped in half. So stuff like that is a big red flag. So that's, yeah. If there's anything widely off on like the financial side, it's a major red flag for us, because I mean, you can always turn things around. But with us like raising investor capital, there's a ticking time clock in the background. You cannot just like play game with the money. So you have to be really up to speed, and there's only so much reserves you can really raise reasonably for before it's just like wasting money. Just throw good money at bad. So that's the biggest one. There's a laundry list after that. For me, the financials is the big one, because it's kind of like the health of the property.
For sure. What are the first 2 to 3 operational changes you implement after closing?
After closing, we usually send out like a tenant survey to see what people want to see changed. And we ask that question too during due diligence when we meet them on site. And then usually do CapEx immediately. Like sometimes, like even before we close, we schedule the stuff already because we know we're going to close. We close day X, and like 2 or 3 weeks later, let's schedule the paving already. You know, that's how much confidence we have, because we want to get it done. We just want to get it out there. Operation improvements, also like getting people on like cash pay and rent manager, or like online payments, of course, preferred, but many people want to do cash payments, so they can do cash pay through rent manager, meaning they can still pay cash at the local retailer, and the retailer scans a barcode, and then that will pay us electronically, rent manager, which is a, you know, best of both worlds. It's huge. I love that.
I think that's like, if you're going to do anything, do that, because that, I mean, we were going to have to hire a person just to open checks, open the mail, and just sit there and open checks all day. So that's a huge efficiency move right there.
It is. Yeah. Whoever came up with this deserves to live on the island right now, for sure. So that's the main one. That's actually the first one. And likely if somebody like the property we're buying right now, they have brand manager, like we usually roll their rent roll into ours, and then people already know cash pay and all that stuff. They just get like a new cash pay number, they get a new account number in rent manager, they know how everything works. But many times it's not the case. So you have to kind of educate people on it, how to pay, sending out the welcome letters and stuff. But like operational improvements, yeah, just digitizing everything, getting CapEx started and scheduled right away. Setting up bank accounts left and right and have everything separated and have all the, it's like a little thing, but we realized like, if you're not on top of it, that falls off radar so fast, like get everything set up like day one, like all the bank accounts are in, you start with the reserves day one, getting the rent payments coming in, have your taxes and insurance escrow accounts ready, have the CapEx account ready, have everything already separated and send up all these auto transfers already. like the profit first mindset. Like if you have an $8,000 a month investor pref you have to pay, pull that out every month, 8,000, like that money is gone. Don't even account for it. You don't have it. It's, you know, that's how we run the financials. So we have always like, you know, in taxes, escrow going out every month and insurance and same for the investor pref and all that stuff going out every month. So it's like out of sight, out of mind. And it's kind of like the profit first mindset. Sure. And pay everybody else first.
We're kind of running out of time. And okay. I just want to make sure I get through some of these because you're a wealth of knowledge. So I like really appreciate you sharing all this with us. I wanted just to go through these real quick. Like talking about deals you've done, right? Like looking back, what's one deal that really moved the needle for you and what specifically made it successful?
The first one, the first syndication, because we, even when we got on the contract or right before we got on the contract, we had no idea how to raise $1.3 million. So that opened up the mindset of we can do it. And then it had a lot of park owner homes, which was another mental barrier to understand how can we turn these over. We knew how because we're doing it from other people, but how are you actually learning when you're actually doing it? And then doing this entire deal, we went from $260,000 NOI when the seller had it to $550,000 in year one. We over doubled the NOI in year one on that because the guy ran at like a 70% expense ratio and we ran at 38. So major turnaround. So that gave us so much confidence that we can take on some really, you know, even ill-ran portfolios. So that one changed everything.
That's great. On the flip side, can you share a deal that didn't go as planned and what you learned from it?
Yeah, there was one. That was actually the first syndication. On paper, really well, conservatively underwritten. The problem is like what we miscalculated is like when you buy in a small market, like with 3,000 people and there's no big town around, the buyer pool for like mismanaged or distressed homes is very small. So getting these off your hands takes forever. And even like we have people passing away, the tenant on homes and the hires don't want to deal with it at all. For example, so you have abandoned tenant on homes. So every time we gain a home or two, then we lose one over here. And it's just getting up on the leasing game there on the small market really bit us in the butt. We still make full pref payments, but we actually have to shut off like asset management fees to us because we couldn't sustain the pref payments. So we always guarantee our investors like, hey, we pay you first and we don't get paid unless you get paid. And this is one of the deals where we had to shut the asset management fee off just because of like the leasing is so much slower in smaller towns. So that one is still probably our worst deal that we ever did. It's still doing pretty decent, but it's definitely not as close as the other ones because the small market dynamics.
Yeah, no, thank you for sharing that. All right, we're going into the lightning round. All right, so nice. Lightning round, no overthinking, no politically correct answers, just your honest, quick take. I got 11 questions that I teed up with my friend ChatGPT. Are you ready for the lightning round?
Let's do it, man.
Wish I had like lights. I could just like flicker the lights right now. Like, dun, dun, dun.
That'd be cool. Need some Metallica in the background. Ride the lightning.
Oh, man. All right. If you could own every mobile home park in one state, which state would it be?
Ooh. Man, we have a lot in South Carolina. I know the market so well. I would say South Carolina, and there's so much growth. I don't live there anymore, but I still love the state. It must be okay. South Carolina for me.
One state you would avoid investing in?
California.
All right. We know why. We don't have to ask.
Yeah.
Biggest lie new operators tell themselves?
They know what they're doing.
One thing gurus teach that doesn't actually work in real life.
Passive income. It must be too subtle.
especially from mobile home parks. There's no such
thing
as passive income. Unless you're just literally an LP.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a good one. Most common reason new owners fail within 2 years.
Oh, it's probably a mindset thing, really. No business skills. Yeah, I just think it's a hobby. It's not a business. I think that's the biggest one, really. They approach it as like a hobby, like a side thing that just is fun. It's fun. I have fun with it, but you have to have the right mindset to make it fun, and it's still a business. So you have to run as a business. I think it's where they fail.
Yeah. Yeah. We've bought in some parks from some people that are like, okay, this seems like a great, you know, thing. And then they buy it and they couldn't sell it fast enough. You know, it'll go down, get downhill fast. All right. Here's a good one. Class C park in a good market or a class A park in an okay one?
I'd take a better market and improve it to a better class, if that makes sense. Yeah. Better market gives you a lot of tailwinds. I'd take that over. Yeah.
Yeah. That's
better
good
quality.
Evict fast or work with tenants?
Evict yesterday. That means fast. That's a German in me. Like, if you don't pay, get out of there. So that's there just me. That's why we love South Carolina, man. I mean, they're out in 30 days. Like, the day of filing, 30 days later, the judges, like, you know, they are so good there. And like the red states, without being political, it's just like so easy to evict people. And it sounds harsh. I just want to make clear to the audience, like, if somebody doesn't pay, they're not supposed to be there. It's my opinion. Because we have a business to run that's also unfair to the other tenants. They're in the park, they're paying their rent with their hard-earned money. So if somebody doesn't pay, they need to go. And I like the state to support that philosophy. So
yeah, no, amen. I hear you on that. Month-to-month leases or longer-term structure?
Month to month. I was actually wrong with that at the beginning because I thought, oh yeah, I want to have it locked in for a year. Then you have to do real estate long enough and you realize they're going to leave when they want anyway. So let's do month to month. At least I can increase rent at any time. So
yeah. And in other commercial real estate, you get benefits, right? You want a 5-year lease, a 10-year lease on like more industrial retail stuff, but not in mobile home parks, at least.
That's correct.
From my perspective. Best predictor that a tenant will become a problem.
Somebody that's constantly on the phone and they're like, it's constantly telling you there's something wrong. And they give, it's just like the over communicator, I think, in a bad way. Of course, there's some that are just like super nice. They don't want to talk to somebody. Of course, they're great. But you can tell within, and they just cuss you out right away. You know, they have a $2,000 balance when you take over the property. And it's like, oh, you're nothing. You know, those people, you know.
Who's the better operator? The one who buys right or the one who manages best?
The one who manages best, because you can buy an average deal and make it great by managing it well, but you can really ruin a great deal if you don't know how to manage it. It's my take on it.
Yeah, no, that's huge. Yeah, that's a good point. If rent control became widespread tomorrow, how would you pivot your strategy?
Oh man, I would think that's back to month-to-month lease. I would increase everybody today as much as possible. it's a good question. That's why I'm going to be keeping a close eye on this, but usually in the Southeast, you don't really have a ton of rent control, even like being proposed. I mean, it's always floats out there, but if you look at the states that have rent control, it doesn't really help supply because money goes where it's treated well. So if you make it more difficult to invest in markets, I think actually it creates problems and bubbles somewhere else. So I think it's not a solution anyway. And I think some states realize that. So even if it hypothetically becomes an issue, I think I probably re-pivot off like where we want to place purchases and acquisitions in the future, to be quite honest. In different states, or let's say you said nationwide, right? So I mean, different asset class even we have to consider, like being that aggressive. Is it actually worthwhile? I don't know. I never even thought about that because I don't think it's like a overnight thing, but
yeah, it's definitely not an overnight thing, but it's just an interesting question to think about.
It is. Yeah. It makes you think.
If you were going to invest passively as an LP into a mobile home park deal with your own money, you know, what's the top things you would look at to ensure, you know, the deal is set up for success?
Track record, to see what they already done, the sponsor. And that's really important. Also, look at some deals that did full cycle in the past. That speaks volumes. Maybe talk to some other investors if they're happy to give you referrals. You know, if you want to invest with somebody to see if they have any referrals and testimonials, I think that's big. Also, look at like if they have properties in that same market already, like that shows they have market knowledge, which is important. Or maybe peers into new markets all the time too, but at least, you know, we have a pretty sizable portfolio. We did it several times before, but I mean, there's always a first time, right? And do you want to place that money in somebody's hands that, you know, creates new proving grounds and tests things? Usually that should be attached with a higher return profile because it's a little bit higher risk. And it's usually, that's what we did in the beginning too. We knew we had no track record, so we gave like high preferred returns. Like our second syndicate had a 10% preferred return. It's wild, but we raised capital pretty easily with a 10 pref. So, sure. And that deal is performing really well. So anyway, you have to ask the right questions, look at the track record. I think that speaks volumes and get some referrals.
Yeah, no, that's good advice. Thanks for that. Well, Matthias, I'm just grateful, man. I know we covered a lot in a short amount of time. Thanks for coming on the show. You know, I really appreciate your insights. If any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you or WCG Investments, where's the best place for them to do so?
Yeah, I'm very active on LinkedIn and Facebook, just my name, Matthias Grunwald. And then also, if you want to reach out on our website, WCG Investments, there's like a discovery call button right there that goes straight to one of us, which is the three founders, which is myself, my partner, Tim Woodbridge, or Vinny Carius, and our team. So you can actually find more about what we do, where we have our acquisitions placed in the future, where opportunities are and stuff like that. But always feel free to reach out personally as well on LinkedIn and Facebook if you have any questions how to get started, or if you're stuck somewhere, happy to help people to kind of show what mistakes we made and how to make sure you don't make them and you don't copy them. So happy to help everybody.
Awesome. Thanks again, Matthias. That's it for today, folks. If you got value out of this episode, please consider leaving us a review. It really helps more listeners find the show. But thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you next time on the Passive Mobile Home Park Investing Podcast. See you guys.
See ya. Thanks, Andrew.
Would you like to see mobile home park value add projects in progress? If so, follow us on Instagram at @passivemhpinvesting for photos and awesome videos from our recent mobile home park acquisitions. Once again, that's @passivemhpinvesting on Instagram. See you there.